Good evening. I can't see anyone, which is the normal fate of lecturing in a big hall like that one. As Bernd Scherer mentioned, I am an anthropologist, but I started my life as a philosopher. And my exposure to animals in the first part of my life, a short one, was mainly to cats and to horses, and of course to the philosophical animal with a capital A, which means that I had very little knowledge of animals. And then I went to Amazonia and I was exposed to a great number of species of animals, a lot of insects, but many other animals also, and this completely shattered my philosophical notion of the animal. And so what I've been doing ever since is trying to understand why people all over the world have such a bewildering diversity of ways not only to conceptualize but to treat non-humans, in particular animals. I'm quite convinced now that these very diverse relations are structured by ontological choices rather than by reasons of utility or even by the specific features that specific animals would universally afford to human perception and experience. Everywhere, human communities form with animal communities, hybrid collectives whose characteristics are highly variable according to the nature of the species which are included in the collective and according to the type of control exerted upon these species. But one thing is clear is that these hybrid collectives are absolutely not anthropocentric. And this is one of the things which has struck me as time went by as an anthropologist reading ethnography of what I like to call extra-modern peoples, is that the usual concepts that we use as anthropologists that we have been using to define social categories, like a lineage or a clan, that is a descent group which is defined by the fact that all the people in the descent group are descended from one human ancestor. All these notions are completely Eurocentric and anthropocentric, because if you look in detail at how people for whom these units are important and relevant, how they conceive them, they are always more than humans in these units. I'll take a few examples. You have to go through a lot of ethnography just to become aware of it. In Niger, there's a group called the Wodabe Peul, who are herders. And in fact, there's a word which is Doudal, and Doudal means at the same time the herd, the cattle herd, and what is traditionally called a lineage. For a long time, Doudal was translated as lineage, but in fact, it includes both cattle and humans, and the cattle that were bred, specific herds of cattle that were bred and selected by humans. In Siberia, among the Tuva herders also, there's a word, Kotakak, which means not only humans, but the camp where the humans live, the yurts, the land, the grazing land that they use, the cattle, of course, the dogs, etc. So it's a word that includes many more than you, much more than humans. And in fact, when there's when there is trouble, when in fact, for instance, the animals are ill, when there's a disease, shaman is brought to cure not the cattle or not the humans, but the whole collective, that is land, people, humans, and non-human persons. So we have there's a huge work to be done, I must say, as anthropology precisely, to reframe all these concepts in order to get them more, their meaning, to get it more precisely established. It is these hybrid collectives are obvious everywhere, not only among herders, but everywhere, whether the animals are hunted and tamed, whether they're hunted and raised, whether they are neither hunted nor raised, whether they are used for their meat, for their secondary product, for the energy they provide as substitutes for humans in sacrifice or exchange, as sources of symbols, as templates for classifications, or for whatever other function. Each of these ways to deal with the animals specifies a particular mode of cohabitation and interaction between particular humans and particular animal species, which renders illusory any universal definition of and philosophical speculation about what could be or should be the relation between man and animal in general. These hybrid collectives of humans and animals do not form according to the vagaries of technical innovations. They are, it seems to me at least, the products of the qualities, positive or negative, that humans have learned to recognize in such or such a species according to the kind of physical and social milieu where they were, the humans, socialized. They are also the product of the qualities that various kinds of animals have sensed and made use among humans, because it's a reciprocal affair. So every human is in a position to detect among certain animal species, provided she comes close enough, traits of behavior that she will be able to interpret by comparing them to her own dispositions. True, this is only possible in cases of relative phylogenic proximity. However, beyond this capacity common to all humans, which allows the sensitive animal and intentional animal that we are to recognize signs of sensory experience and intentional action in forms of life that are not too distant from ours, the qualities that we infer in non-humans also vary according to the milieu where we were raised. If I perceive the animal which crosses my path as a reincarnation of my grandmother, as the vehicle of an evil spell, as a cherished companion, as a vector of disease, or as an ambulatory piece of meat, I will not treat it in the same fashion. So there is no animal with a capital A in general. There is only a bewildering diversity of animals with which humans, themselves very diverse, have established in the course of time very contrasted links according to the qualities they perceive in them or ascribe to them. Besides, as Bernd Scherer mentioned, studies in ethnobiological classifications have amply shown that most non-European languages lack a word which is equivalent to our word animal, which would subsume under a supra-generic taxon a great number of forms of life. What there is are a series of terms that designate animals. The usual number that a knowledgeable person in an extra-modern people know is around 500, but there are people who know over 1,500 names, And these names are in fact memorized because there is a relationship between the animal that was first seen, for instance, the first encounter, so there's a memory of the place where it was seen first. And there are techniques like that to memorize a great number of names of animals in flat taxonomies rather than vertical taxonomies as the one we are used in the Linnaean tradition. So, of course, no doubt that some similarities between animal species have been everywhere noticed. But this necessity did not arise everywhere. Did not arise everywhere for a term that would synthesize some of these resemblances within an unlikely category, which, when you come to think of it, in the four categories of European languages, the taxon animal spans from the bacteria to the blue whale. So it's rather counterintuitive, and it emphasizes the philosophical character of this notion. A little exercise in comparative ornithology may allow us to understand better the huge differences observable among humans in the ideas they form of animals and in the treatment deriving from them. I'll begin with an Australian example. The Noongar tribes of the southwest of Australia were organized in moieties, that is, the humans were divided into moieties, and these moieties were named after birds. On the one hand, the white cockatoo, whose native name, Marnech, can be translated as the getter, and the crow, called Vachdar, a word which means the watcher. So, designating an animal species by a general feature of behavior, as is the case here, rather than by an exclusive term, is very common in Australian languages. And it stems from the status given to these totemic birds. They are the sources and the substantial embodiments of two contrasted sets of material and spiritual qualities, to use our own language: character traits, bodily aptitudes, mental dispositions, which are said to be specific to all the human members of each of the moieties, as well as to all the non-human respectively affiliated to these two moieties. So this community of dispositions, of tempers, of temperaments within hybrid collectives had already been noticed more than a century ago by two pioneers of the ethnography of the Australian Aboriginals, William Spencer and Frank Gillen, when they wrote apropos the people of Central Australia, I quote them, "The identity of the human individual is often sunk in that of the animal or plant from which he is supposed to have originated." So it is not the case here that such an identification takes as a basis a particular crow or a particular cockatoo observable in the environment. Rather, these two species constitute sort of emblems of a physical and moral relation of identity between the certain components of the world, humans and non-humans, a relation which encompasses and cancels the apparent morphological and functional differences between these components, the better to emphasize a common ground of ontological similarities. There's another quote by Spencer and Gillen, which I found extremely interesting. They presented a photograph of an arrondamen in Central Australia to him, and he said, "Well, this one looks like me much as the kangaroo does." So in the same statement, at the same time, he recognizes the relation of morphological identity between himself and an image, and at the same time, he cancels this relation of identity, because what he implies is that there is not a morphological identity, but there is an ontological identity in the sense that they share the same set of qualities, let's say. Far from Australia, on the central plateau of Mexico, the Otomi Indians also entertain a relation of identification with birds, in particular the black vulture. This bird, which is feeding on carrion and garbage, is the most common avatar of what is called the tona, which is an animal double, whose life cycle is parallel to that of each human to which it is paired, since it is born and it dies on the same day as the human, and his life cycle is parallel to that of the human to which it is paired, since it is born and it dies on the same day. And everything which affects the one, in particular which affects the physical integrity, affects the other. This notion of tona was formally labeled at the beginning of the 20th century by anthropologists and folklorists as Nahualism. And it was considered as a belief that was offered a kind of vivid proof of the same kind of incapacity to distinguish between man with a capital M and animal with a capital A that the Australian Aborigines manifested. But it should be obvious that the destiny shared by a human person and her animal double, as posited by the Otomi and by numerous other people in Mesoamerica and Central America, is quite different from the material and spiritual continuity posited by the Noongar between humans and birds. To begin with, because the animal, in the Otomi case, is an individual, not a prototypical species embodying shared properties, but also because a human does not possess the idiosyncratic features of the animal replica to which she is coupled. If it is a vulture, if the tona is a vulture, for instance, the human will not feed on putrid meat or perch in trees. So there is no physical or behavioral resemblance between the elements of the pair, the more so as the human usually ignores to what species his tona or her tona belongs. On the contrary, then, and this is why hunting, of course, is a dangerous business in all this area, because you may ending up by killing your tona, which means you are killing yourself. So it is necessary in that case that the human and her animal alter ego be distinguished in essence and in substance, again using our old Aristotelian tools, for a relation of analogical correspondence to exist between them and for the accidents that first befall one element of the pair to affect the other element as though through a reverberation. I'm not talking here of a lost tribe somewhere far away. The number of people for whom there are tona in their environment is more or less equivalent to the number of inhabitants in Germany. So we are not talking about lost tribes here. Further south in the upper Amazon, where I was fortunate enough to live for a few years, the Achua, with whom I lived, grant an eminent position to yet another bird, the toucan. Like other birds and mammals, the toucan is said to possess what we translate usually as a soul. The native term is wakan, which is similar to that of humans. So the possession of a soul is a disposition which qualifies the toucan, as well as most other animals, as a person. The word in Quechua is eins. So it's an ontological category which is composed of all the beings endowed with subjectivity, with intentionality, and who are able to communicate in certain circumstances with all the other persons, whether human or non-human, in their surroundings. So thanks to this internal disposition, the toucan, which I must add is the most common meat also, because it's the most easily hunted animal, the toucan is said to abide by the principles and values which rule social life among the Quechua. In particular, the toucan is the exemplary embodiment among non-humans of the figure of the brother-in-law, a term with which it is sometimes referred to in certain contexts. This makes of the toucan the typical partner in relations of affinity that men maintain with game animals. And one can see, so the common way to establish this relation of affinity is through dreams and also through songs, which are directed from the soul of the singer to the soul of the animal. And in dreams, game animals, in particular the toucan, appear as humans, and so it establishes the possibility of a conversation. But as you can see, the human qualities shared by the Quechua and the toucans are of a moral and not of a physical nature. They are identical interiorities. The foundation of what they have in common are lodged in bodies with differential qualities, bodies which define and render manifest the borders between the separate collectives where their respective lives unfold. So by contrast with the vulture of the Otomi, which is an anonymous singularity, which remains foreign to the human person to which it is coupled by an identical destiny, the toucan of the Quechua is thus a member of a collective analogous to that of humans, the collective of toucans, which is ruled by the same social rules, but that the humans cannot see, because the toucans lead their lives as sort of humans, far from the view of humans. But it's a monospecific collective in that sense, and all collectives are monospecific. As such, the toucan becomes the potential subject of a relation of sociality with any other entity, human or non-human, placed in a similar situation. So what we call society, in a case like that, and it's common among all animist collectives in many parts of the world, humans are no more than animals, a generic category. They are collectives of humans which are considered as what I call tribe species. That is, they have their own way of feeding, they have their own way of ornamenting themselves, they have their own weapons, their own tools, their own languages, and all these are seen exactly as the implements that any animal species will use in order to live in a specific world. And all these collectives are monospecific and entertain relations of sociality, the one with the other. And it is, of course, an obvious example that this notion of society, which we use in the social sciences, is completely irrelevant to define the kind of sociality that is conceptualized and practiced in this kind of context. The toucan also differs from the Australian totemic birds in that there is no physical continuity between the humans and the bird, but rather the reverse, because of his anatomical dispositions and behavioral propensities, the toucan lives in a world which intersects only partially with that of humans. In spite of that, the toucan is said to model his moral rules and social institutions on those of humans, while in Australia, it is rather the humans who, differently according to the hybrid totemic collectives of the one to which they belong, are said to be the actualizations of the totemic prototype of which the two birds are respectively the best exemplars. Let us turn now to the Western world, more specifically to the European early modernity, and consider the qualities that were granted to the parrot, which of course is an exotic bird, but one whose troubling capacity to mimic the human speech has long provided occasion for diversion and pretext for philosophical distinctions. Philosophers such as Descartes, Locke, or Leibniz have emphasized that the sentences uttered by the parrot in no way provide an index of its humanity, since the bird cannot adapt the impressions that it receives from external objects to signs which it only reproduces by imitation. This being the reason, that such goes the argument by the philosophers, such being the reason why it cannot invent new languages. So in Cartesian philosophy, taken here rather as a sort of ontological charter of early modernity, animals, as you know, are purely material beings because they cannot a priori participate to this non-extended substance, which is the soul. And although this position has been challenged, a vast majority of modern Westerners nevertheless still cling to this position when they acknowledge spontaneously that humans differ from non-humans by reflexive consciousness, by subjectivity, by the ability to signify, by the mastery of symbols, and by the exercise of language through which all these faculties are expressed. And these Westerners also hardly doubt the implicit consequence of the postulate, namely that the contingency inherent to the capacity to produce arbitrary signs has led humans to differentiate between themselves by the form they give to their conventions, and this as a result of a collective disposition which was known in French as le génie d'un peuple, in German as Volksgeist, and that we now prefer to call culture. Finally, and much as Descartes and in his animal machine, but with the weightier foundations of Darwinism, the same Westerners readily acknowledge that the physical component of their humanity locates them in a material continuum within which they do not stand out in relation to other organized beings. So the laws of physics, of chemistry, of biology apply to them as well. in short, the accepted premise of what may be called a naturalist ontology is that we differ from animals by the mind, not by the body. So these four examples of relations to birds illustrate very dissimilar ways of inferring qualities or detecting qualities in birds, and more generally in what we call animals. Henceforth, it illustrates very different ways of conceiving the relations with animals that these qualities afford. And afford as a way, in a way, to be actualized. In the Australian case, for instance, animals are taken as emblems of relatively abstract qualities which certain humans and certain non-humans share and which establish their common identity beyond the visible differences of form. So the bird is a sort of best exemplar of a prototype which existed a long time ago, but which is still active in its process of morphogenesis, of producing, but morphogenesis not in the sense of the form, but in the sense of producing ontologically specific classes of beings which are morphologically distinct but ontologically similar. In the Mexican case, animals provide one of the terms in the relation of correspondence between a human and a human individual and an animal individual, unknown to each other, but who share a common destiny. So what is relevant here is the relationship between two elements, a relationship of correspondence, of analogy, which in fact can be extended in a much wider way to all the components of the world. In the Amazonian case, animals are treated as subjects with whom relations of person to person can be maintained, entertained. Finally, in the modern Western tradition, animals are rather conceived as animated things which present physical similarities with humans. And note that it is only in the last formula, the one most familiar to us, in this formula that it can lend itself to an idea of juridical empowerment of animals. By contrast with the three other ontological regimes, animals are seen in the naturalist ontology as objects devoid of moral dignity in that they lack reflexivity, hence responsibility for their deeds, and are thus susceptible, for some of them, to come under the dependence or under the protection of humans as alienable objects or as endangered species. And it is this dependency, as well as the human-like dispositions some animals manifest in communication, in the use of tools, in cognition, in sensibility, which converts a few of them, a few species, into candidates for emancipation. Such a perspective would be completely meaningless for the crow or for the cockatoo with the Australian Noongar, which represent bundles of qualities, bundles of attributes, identical to those of the humans affiliated to their respective totemic classes, and thus not enough in a way distinguishable from the humans to become the object of a human control. It would be also completely meaningless for the toucan of the Achua, with a social partner of the hunter, who may admittedly end up in the cooking pot But with all the consideration due to his position, not only are Amazonian collectives hunters, human collective hunters, human tribe species hunters, they are also great pet collectors, and these are the same animals. So in Amazonia, most houses house many, many pets, which are wild animals that have been taken into the house when they were very little and raised, usually mouth-fed or breastfed, and transformed into pets. They are not brutalized, they are not killed, they are not eaten, it's not a proto-domestication. It's a diverging way between, on the one hand, predation, and on the other hand, a sort of temporary affiliation to a human collective, but which is always temporary in the sense that they still belong to the master of the game, the spirit master of the game. And if they are brutalized, in particular, the retaliation from the master of the game will be felt. So it's not protection in a traditional sense. It's an affiliation within another collective than the one in which these animals were born. And the reverse is true also for shamans who are affiliated in other collectives, in jaguar collectives, for instance, in order to be able to visit animal communities and to plead for these animal communities not to bother anymore humans. As for the animal doubles that the otomi grant to humans, they are all the less likely to be liberated from human brutality that any such abuse would have, of course, immediate repercussion on their human doubles. So I have reviewed briefly different ways to treat and to conceptualize different kinds of birds according to salient qualities, or at least salient qualities that humans detect in them or ascribe to them, a process which should prompt us not to generalize to the rest of the world attitudes, types of behavior, forms of sensibility towards animals which are common in Europe and in North America. These attitudes have resulted from a particular historical process which testifies to a growing concern in the past two centuries, let's say, with the welfare of certain animal species. These species who were under the gaze of the urban elites, either directly or through the consumption of exotica via the mass media. Even in the West, globally speaking, the variety of attitudes is bewildering according to the species considered, according to the degree of familiarity with such or such a species, and according to the habits of the social milieu or those transmitted within local traditions. So to the question, what is an animal? One which, as I said, offered endless topics for essays when I was a student in philosophy, there is no reasonable answer beside or beyond that provided by unbiased observation. It is the class of living beings in which I can find the most immediate support for an identification with a non-human, provided certain features of its appearance and behavior afford me the possibility to do so. Of course, it's easier to identify oneself with a bear than it is with a clam, because in its figure and behavior, the bear probably provides a more adequate basis for what Rousseau called pity. Pity, that is the particular feeling which, to quote Lévi-Strauss commenting Rousseau precisely, ensues from the identification to another who is not only akin, a close relative, a compatriot, but any human provided he or she is human and more, whatever, this is the important aspect, whatever living being provided it is alive. But what I make of this potentiality, of this pity for identification, is another matter. It is largely determined by the ontological choices which I have learned to admit as true in the milieu where I was raised. In short, there are as many genres of relations between humans and non-human, or human and non-human animals, of there are genres of treatment of humans by humans, of humans by animals, of animals by animals. It is thus, it seems to me, incautious to convert the very specific relations with the limited number of animals that have developed in the course of the last century among the urban elites of northern nations into the moral, philosophical, and legal basis for regulating the relations between the whole assemblage of humans and the whole assemblage of animals. So to conclude, as you may have understood, I'm not necessarily in favor of granting specific rights to specific animal species because they are closer to humans or because they could be admitted to the select club of anthropocentric creatures that we are. I'm more in favor of granting, and this is a reivindication by extra-modern people that is becoming more and more common, of granting rights of personal, juridical personhood to ecosystems, that is, to forms of relations specifically located in specific places that exist between humans and humans and non-humans, which can be considered as remarkably original and as such need to be maintained. Unfortunately, it has started to be the case with, for instance, the case of the river in New Zealand, the Whanganui River. There's another river in Colombia, the Atrato, that was also given personal juridical personhood. And so I think this view is more interesting to explore than granting specific rights to animals, because it would be, in fact, to expand the possessive individualism of, in fact, capitalism to non-humans in a way which would certainly prevent this mad idea of individualism, on which, again, capitalism is partly based, which would prevent from disappearing and finding new ways of entering into relations with all the components of our world, in fact. Thank you.